Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. It's a very real pleasure for me to introduce Sir Robin Butler to you. Although we might not necessarily look it, we are indeed exactly the same age and have been friends for perhaps longer than either of us care to remember. But Sir Robin has had almost, I guess, now unparalleled proximity to the centre of political power in the course of his career as a civil servant. He went to Oxford, as so many civil servants do, and joined the civil servants immediately. He became private secretary to Edward Heath, then to Harold Wilson in Downing Street, went back to the Treasury for a while, and then became, of course, closely associated as secretary of the cabinet with, principal private secretary and then secretary of the cabinet with Margaret Thatcher and now, of course, John Major. So he's worked very closely and very intimately with four prime ministers, which must be a record. A record for now. He thus has had an unrivaled insight into the problems and practices of political power at the very centre, and it gives me very great pleasure to invite him now to address you. He tells me he will speak for about 25 minutes and then we'll have about half an hour discussion, which I shall chair rigorously. Robin.
Well, thank you, John. I don't know whether four prime ministers are a record. Actually, thinking while you said that, I guess that Hankey, who was cabinet secretary from 1916 to 1938, must have had rather more, quite a lot more, actually. But in a short compass, I suppose it's very great honour to come and speak in this room where I've heard very many distinguished lectures, and it's very greatly appreciate having the opportunity to give one. I'm talking to you about where the civil service is and where it's going. And it occurred to me that I never thought the day would come when I would compare the situation of the civil service to that of Russia. But there are some similarities. You have the apostle of reform, the Gaidar of civil service reform, if you like, in the form of Sir Peter Kemp, who has been writing to the newspapers and saying that the mission has been betrayed, as he put it, the escape committee has been put in the hands of the jailers. And you have only on Friday a former head of the civil service, Lord Bancroft, and Sir John Herbeck. Not that I would want to compare them with the Brezhnevites, but writing to the Times and saying that they're worried by the accelerating breakup of the Home Civil Service and the long-run effects this may have on the efficiency and integrity of the public administration of our country. And went on to say, there are powerful reasons for retaining the civil service in its unified form. If the fastidiousness of its standards is perceived to decline, all citizens are diminished. And those are serious words. Well, it would be one way of expressing it to say that if you're being criticised both by the reformers for having betrayed the reforms and their predecessors for saying you've gone too far, that you've got the balance about right. But I think that actually would be facile. And so what I want to do is to go into a little bit more depth to what has been happening to the civil service, setting it in a historical context and seeing if we can strike some balance about the way it's changing and what is being gained, what has been left untouched, and what is being lost or what is at risk of being lost. Just go in for a little bit of the history. You will all know that the essential features of the modern civil service took their shape from the Northcott Trevelyan report of 1854. Not easily, be it said, it's right to remind ourselves that the principles of that report took 20 years of fierce political argument before they became accepted. But the structure that took that that put in place was, first of all, a permanent civil service, in the sense of a civil service expected to serve successive governments of whatever political colour with equal loyalty. Secondly, that its members should be recruited by open and public examination, and that they should be promoted on merit and not by political patronage. Northcote Trevelyan envisaged, indeed advocated, that it should be a career for life. It spoke in a way that is now extraordinarily dated of young men, no mention of young women, young men being recruited at an early stage of their lives when they were most amenable to being trained and developed in the public service. And indeed, when I joined the civil service, only just over 30 years ago, still the top age of applying to join the administrative grade of the civil service was 26. There is now no age limit, but it's interesting to recall how recently you either joined at the beginning or not at all, and you were expected to stay for life. Northcote Trevelyan recommended a separation of what it described as the intellectual and the mechanical roles of government, i.e., the top hamper were concerned with intellectual matters, policy, close to ministers, should be chosen for their intellectual qualities. And again, when I joined the civil service, you could enter entirely by an academic exam without any interview or management or test of personal qualities other than that at all. And that separation of the intellectual and the mechanical was reflected in the division between the administrative civil service, as it was called, and the executive class, that were, as it were, the mechanicals of government that carried out the executive tasks. It established a division between the minister and the civil servant. The minister, who was subject to the election of the people who came and went, and the civil servant who continued, and their interests clearly therefore differed. And it established a distinction between public and private interest, which should not be allowed to infect each other, and which has been a principle of British public life ever since. Those were the essential features of the Northcote Trevelyan system. Over successive years, the civil service then developed on that basis and was given, as it were, a horizontal coherence, by which I mean that there were common terms and conditions across all departments. There was an administrative cadre that was expected to serve in any department of state, that was recruited in a group, that was always paid on the same basis, and was managed as a group, and from which permanent secretaries of any department were selected centrally. And that particularly took its shape under Warren Fisher, who was head of the civil service from 1919 to 1942, and it was reflected in what was known as the Whitley system, which was a system by which the civil service management and trade unions met together in a very cozy Whitley cooperative system, and pay was determined by comparisons with the private sector, and there was never any question of negotiation or dispute. It was mechanically settled by what we call fair comparisons with the private sector. And the civil service basically went on in that shape through the early part of this century, and what really changed about it during that time was not these basic structures, but its size. It grew with the first development of the welfare state in the early years of this century, through the First World War and through the Second World War. And by the time of the 1970s, it was 10 times the size of what it had been in the early years of the century, 500,000 as against 50,000 people. And that sort of rather cozy arrangement continued until the 1960s, when the dissatisfaction with the civil service first manifested itself in a serious form and led to the Fulton Report of 1968. And the Fulton Report was really, I think, a watershed. And what was the nature of that dissatisfaction? First of all, there was a dissatisfaction with the general administrative cadre which had been put in place with Northcote by Northcote Trevelyan. The group who were chosen for their general intellectual qualities, very often arts educated, who were expected to be able to carry out any high policy function of the state in whatever area. And people felt in the 1960s that the world had become more specialist than that. There were things like economists and scientists and accountants for whom this system did not properly cater. They felt that the work of government had become more managerial, that people who were in an ivory tower concentrated on devising policies for ministers and regarded that as the end of their role, could no longer be expected to run what were by then the big businesses of the welfare state, let alone lead an industrial nation, which was already then, people were conscious of its relative decline in relation to its competitors, that the countries which it had been ahead of before the war, it had defeated in the war, were then already overtaking it, and there was a great feeling of frustration about that. They felt that there should be more personal responsibility, that the idea of a job for life, which was a virtue of the Northcote-Trevelyan reforms, because they felt that it protected people from political corruption if they were secure in their positions, that job for life was too cozy an arrangement and that it was an out-of-date arrangement. They felt that there should be more personal responsibility, that the minister taking responsibility for any failure of government and civil servants, as it were, being invisible and always protected behind them, didn't reflect the realities of a complex political system where ministers couldn't effectively be responsible for everything. And they felt that civil servants needed much more effort and to training once they had already been recruited. And as I said, I think that Fulton was a watershed on all that. It ended the insulation of the administrative class from the specialists. It produced what is called in the jargon of the civil service the open structure, whereby in the senior civil service you make no differentiation between specialisms, between administrators, between economists, between scientists. They all become part of the management group, so that it's very much easier to penetrate and very much easier for people to cross from specialisms into general management. The Civil Service College was founded. The first agencies with more personal responsibility were increased. And just as Fulton was a watershed on the structure, so the IMF crisis of 1976 was a watershed on cost. Even it's often forgotten that even before the Conservative government came in 1979, the Labour government had set themselves to reduce the size of the civil service. And indeed, the civil service, the decline in the size of the civil service dates from 1976, not from 1979. When the Conservatives came in 1979, they gave greater impetus to that. They set targets for the reduction of the size of the civil service. Regardless of functions, they simply told each department that they had to reduce their numbers by something like 15%. And I remember I was the principal establishment officer in the Treasury during that time, and one just had to find a reduction of 15% and get through the work. It was actually a very effective way of doing it. It was quite fun to do in a way, and we did it. I mean, the civil service did it, and by 1983, it was some 20% smaller than it had been in 1976, partly through just getting rid of numbers, partly through hiving things out to the private sector. A whole range of means were used. And at the same time, in the beginning of the Conservative government, they began to direct their focus on managerial efficiency. They had an initiative called the Financial Management Initiative, and that led to the Next Steps initiative of 1988, which gave much more of a sense to the creation of functions as agencies and personal responsibility for them. But it's quite an interesting aspect of the Conservatives' policy towards the civil service, again, not often noticed, that has changed quite radically in the period in which they've been in office. They have moved from a concentration on numbers, on quantity, to a much more focus on quality with the Citizens' Charter. And privatization has come in much more strongly after the success of the privatization starting with British Telecom in the early 1980s. That has spread from the nationalized industries, from the public industries, until it is now much more of a theme of the Conservatives' present policy towards the civil service itself. And so now we've got a time when a lot of the executive functions of government have been set up as agencies. Over 60% of the civil service is now formed as agencies, with chief executives in charge of them, who are personally responsible to the minister for the performance of those services. The standard terms and conditions that were set up with such difficulty by Warren Fisher have gone. Jobs for life have gone. A lot of the most senior posts are now open to open competition. As I said, recruitment, there is no age limit on recruitment. That takes place at all stages of career. And on top of that, more recently, there has been much greater competition introduced in the civil service, and especially the market testing initiative, by which the government really challenges all functions of government, not the most obvious executive ones like cleaning, catering, security guards, but things that go to the center of professional advice, like legal service, audit, accountancy, and things that go into the area of policy advice, are put out to tender, and the civil service tenders for it in competition with the big consultancy houses, accountancy houses, or the specialists, and wins about half of them, often with very considerable savings in the cost with which they're produced, and loses about half of them, with the result that the jobs go out into the private sector. So this is a huge change that is going on, where a lot of the things for which Northcote Trevelyan claimed merit, of the secure job for life, where you could be therefore free from any political contamination, are replaced by a much more managerial approach where there are not jobs for life, people compete, and they're subject to very much more of the winds of change, winds of competition that apply in the private sector. So if one tries to strike a balance sheet, what has the civil service lost of the Northcott-Trevelyan pattern? Well, slightly to repeat myself, it's lost the lifetime career, it's lost standard conditions of service, it's lost the cult of the generalist who can do anything across the government, it's lost its mainly male London-based aspect, because now with information technology you can take the jobs out to where the available labour is, and the civil service has been dispersed all around the country as a result. It's lost central control because there's much greater delegation. Pay is not negotiated centrally. It's much more spread across the board. And it has lost the split between intellectual and mechanical functions for which Northcott-Trevelyan claimed a virtue. What have we got left? We've got left a permanent civil service in the sense that it is still expected to serve governments of any political colour. It has therefore got, compared with the American system, a split between the civil service and the ministers. Civil servants do not depart or arrive with ministers, and therefore their interests are different from those of ministers. It has more extended, we still have open competition, but it has been more extended. We still have high standards of integrity that we apply a value to, and we still have, and what binds the civil service together, is accountability to through ministers to Parliament. But a lot of the things that did bind the civil service together in the terms of common standards across common terms and conditions across the board have gone. And so it is really this feature of accountability through ministers to Parliament which identifies the civil service and one relies on to hold it together. What have we gained? I think we have gained greater openness to professionalism and a greater respect for professionalism. I think we've gained more personal responsibility, and contrary to what is often supposed, people like that. They like being in charge of services, having resources to carry them out, and being accountable to the for the results. We have more concentration on what the services are meant to produce, passports within 3 weeks instead of 3 months, driving tests within 7 weeks instead of 3 months, that sort of thing. And we have much greater exposure to competition from the private sector. You can't, I think, just as it were, simply strike a balance and say in these respects it's better or in these respects it's worse. I think that it has had to respond to the demands of modern life in these ways. I'm certainly absolutely clear that the political pressures on government, and they will be on government of any colour, are to produce better public services without increasing taxation. And that is something which obviously imposes a great pressure for greater productivity from the system. Delegation, putting more power in the hands of individuals down the line, getting rid of the command structure, does give greater scope for corruption, and it gives greater scope for mistakes. And if those are going to be avoided, and it's as important in our administration as it ever was that they should be avoided, they must be avoided not by a command structure by which nobody takes an initiative without going up the line, but by strong auditing and personal vulnerability. People being fired for corruption and being fired in many cases or having their contracts not renewed for inefficiency. And the other risk that one has, if that one has appointments being made all the way up the structure, open competition for the most senior posts, there is clearly a greater risk of politicization and ministerial influence. And that you've got to counter by keeping it in the hands of a non-political body like the Civil Service Commission, and that is what we have tried to do. So what we're trying to do is to get the advantages of a more modern structure, managed in a more efficient way, with the old virtues of impartiality and integrity and objectivity. And that is the trick that we're trying to pull off. And I think we've got to try to pull it off. It isn't easy, but I think that it's possible. And when one says, are we going down the right track, I think two things are clear. First, a number of other countries are following us. The Gore-Clinton program is very similar to the program which we're following. Reinventing Government by Gabler and Osborne was written independently, but is so similar that when David Osborne came over here, he thought that somebody had had a privy view of his text and plagiarized it from our program. But in fact, actually, we've been doing it a good deal before Gabriel and Osborne even started writing. And there is a good degree of bipartisan support for it on the Next Steps initiative, on delegation and personal responsibility, though there are dissenters from those, particularly in the form of Gerald Kaufman, who doesn't like getting replies from heads of agencies rather than from ministers, and on the emphasis on quality. We know that the Labour Party would have introduced a citizens' charter if they had been returned to government. There is a difference between the parties on competition with the private sector, on public versus private ownership, and on transfer to the private sector. And so that is an area of political dispute. But on competition, I think the Labour Party would go quite a long way to the with the government. And there is still agreement between the parties on the Northcote Trevelyan qualities of the civil service that we're trying to maintain, i.e. on appointment and promotion on merit, by open competition, on integrity, on the non-politicization of appointments. So where is the civil service, in my last few moments, going from here? Well, I think I would say that the directions it will go will be these. On structure and organization, delegation and diversification will continue. Executive agencies, non-departmental public bodies, which is the long-winded word for quangos, will continue because they are executive bodies formed for carrying out particular functions. And I can't see any likelihood of return to the big is beautiful theory of the 1960s and the 1970s. I think we will continue to operate in government as in business, in small accountable units. The size of the civil service will diminish. I can't say precisely to what end, though my colleagues would like me to, not least because the government says it depends on competition. These tenders between the government and the private sector. And one can't predict to what extent the civil service will continue to win those, but it will certainly lose some. and therefore the size of the civil service will certainly reduce. But there will be counterweights to this, in my view, which will stop these tendencies going far enough to do what Lord Bancroft and Sir John Herbeck feared, which is to break up a single civil service. And the reason it won't go so far as that is that there is more need than ever for government policies to be seen as coherently designed. It simply isn't possible for the benefits agency to run the social security system in a quite separate pocket and entirely insulated, for example, from the way in which the employment service is operating. And you could multiply examples of that across the whole of government. I think that there will be experimentation with new management approaches. There will be better openness, greater, more openness and better audit process, which will Parliament rightly ought to force upon us, even if, however traditionally, the government is reluctant to engage on those sort of things. And so, to that extent, horizontal ties will be retained. But there will be much more in the way of contact and joint ventures with the private sector. And it's significant that the Labour Party now has moved towards espousing private finance, the financing of public developments in partnership with the public sector, another area in which they're going down with whatever differences of emphasis, a bipartisan approach. The impact of Europe, of course, will continue to increase, irrespective, in my view, of the speed of political development. There will be more and more policies which have to be negotiated with the partners and administered with the partners. And our life will become increasingly intertwined with Brussels. Information technology will continue to reduce the great clerical factories and will distribute civil service jobs around the country. But despite all these changes, I hope and believe that the civil service will continue to be non-political. We can go the American way. I foresee no great desire that we should do so. But there are those tendencies in the system, and they're reinforced by the greater public profile of individual civil servants. Our appearance before select committees and the identification with responsibility for the execution of public services. Those are tendencies which will point in the direction of politicization. We will resist it if the public and successive governments want to resist it. And in my view, just by these developments, by pointing up, by focusing attention on the dangers of politicization, will in fact help to avoid it. So that, I think, is the picture of the civil service that I would want to paint to you. There are very great changes going on. They are changes which can endanger the traditional strengths of the civil service. I think we have no choice but to render ourselves vulnerable, if you like, to those dangers. But I don't think that it follows that the traditional strengths of the British civil service, its non-political character, its impartiality, and its integrity, need be sacrificed by the requirements of modern management.
Well, I think we can probably use this microphone to deal with the questions. And I should have said, when introducing Sir Robin, that as well as being Secretary of the Cabinet, he is, of course, head of the civil service. And what you've just heard is a lecture by the head of the civil service. And I'd be grateful if we could restrict our questions to you, if I may, Robin, in that role. fascinated, though many are, no doubt, about the duties of the Secretary of the Cabinet. First question. Any questions?
No need for them to restrict themselves too much. It's kind of you. But I mean, let's do the civil service first. If we run out of questions on the civil service, I don't mind the rest. I'll duck the questions I'm not prepared to answer.
Right, yes, a little.
Well, the answer to that is yes, it does, but there is a particular complication which you may have in mind at the moment, which is that the Commission have rules about free movement of labour, which make it incumbent upon all members to open up government as opposed to other jobs to all members of the community. But they do allow certain protected areas to be defined so that there are all members of the community can specify a pretty narrow range of jobs at the centre of their governments which they're not prepared to open to members of other parts of the community. Now that actually has created a problem for the civil service because we've had no restriction of that sort in the past as regards Irish citizens. And in order, it's one of these curious things where in order to correspond with community law, we may, in respect of Irish citizens, have to introduce a narrow restriction of a sort that has never been there before. And I just wonder if that's what's lying behind your question. But apart from that technicality, there is no only in the small restrictive direction that I have discussed. No. If you're a British citizen, then you can't restrict in any way.
There was another. Yes, ma'am.
I think that the civil service is getting a bad press out of the Scott inquiry. You know, the story's not over yet. It's not over until the fat lady sings, as they say. I mean, we'll have to, not until Justice Scott is a fat lady, but we'll have to see what the, we'll have to see what the report says. What I hope it will find, what I'm confident it will find, is that the wilder allegations that were made when the Scott inquiry was set up, which was that there was a conspiracy at the centre of government to conceal from Parliament the secret rearming of Iraq and the attempt to send innocent men to jail, would be found to have no substance in it. There may well be, it'd be surprising for the word, some other criticisms. But I can genuinely say, I don't know whether there's any press here, I can genuinely say that I think that the standards of administration that I've seen have come out of Scott, and certainly the recording of everything so that he can conduct this inquiry, give no reason to be ashamed.
I should perhaps say I'm not sure whether there are any press here, but I've discovered a fair rule of thumb to assume that any LSE student can turn his or her hand to journalism at the drop of a telephone. Yes, at the back there.
Do you think that the core function of the policy advice can't ever be reflected out of the private sector, or is everything up to that?
Well, I think that the area where you can look for outside advice is a good deal wider than people have traditionally supposed, if you want to do that. I mean, if you take, for example, could then engage the private sector forecasters to give policy advice on the basis of their forecasting. You could then discontinue the Treasury or large parts of the Treasury. So I think that there isn't a lot of limit to what you can do. I happen to think, however, that a lot of the essence of business of the senior civil service, of being close to ministers, living in this world of political administration, is not a job that you can do without any training and just simply pick up in return for a contract. Quite contrary to what Fulton sometimes suggested, or impression you might get from Yes Minister, this is a very specialised business for which you need quite a lot of training. So I don't think it'll work so well to contract a lot of it out. And I think that there are certainly areas like adjudication which should not be put in the hands of the private sector. There's been some quite interesting American work done on those areas which are essentially government operations and which should stay in the hands of the government. Tax assessment might be such a thing. You could imagine contracting that out. Indeed, in the Roman Empire, they did, but I don't think it would work. Enormously well. My argument is about the agencies, that they don't diminish accountability to Parliament, they increase it. Because the chain of accountability through ministers is unbroken. It is not open to a minister to say, this is no responsibility of mine. I appointed Michael Bichard to be head of the benefits agency. I left him to run this. I am not going to answer for it. The agencies don't work like that. The minister remains accountable. And although if you write in to the Secretary of State for Social Security about a Social Security point, you will first of all get an answer from Mr. Bichard. If you're not satisfied with that answer, if you're an MP or a member of the public, it is your right to go back to the Secretary of State and get an answer from him. But in my view, identifying Mr. Bichard as the man who runs the agency and allowing him to be called up before the Select Committee of Parliament increases the accountability of the system, because the fact is that in a complex society the minister can't run in everything and can't know all that's going on. An interesting example of this, where the question of, as it were, ministerial resignation came into play, was the breakout from Brixton Prison of what they call Macaulay and Quinlivan. Now, should the Home Secretary resign in a situation of that sort? In my view, not. I mean, it is clearly the responsibility of the governor of Brixton Prison to keep the prisoners in, and that is the person that ought to be accountable. What Parliament can rightly hold the minister accountable is taking action to replace, discipline, appoint somebody else. If some failure happens, for which action over which action needs to be taken, or they can hold the minister accountable for not giving the chief executive the resources to do it. So my argument is that by identifying the people in the system who are responsible for these services, you increase accountability. Gerald Corfman, as I say, doesn't like that and doesn't agree with it. He thinks that whenever he writes a letter about an executive matter,
he's got a right to expect an answer from the minister first time and to hold the minister responsible. I disagree with that, because I think, I mean, although you can, as I say, you will always be able to hold the minister nominally accountable, actually in the system, people who are responsible, people further down the line, and you ought to be able to get at them in the first instance and only the minister in the second instance. I'm afraid it's a rather long-winded answer, but have I got to the point eventually that you're up?
Yes.
Ministers authorise, they're given on account of this. Now, answers, well, let me try and deal with this. Any answer to Parliament has to be incomplete in the sense that you very rarely have the opportunity to say everything that you know about a subject. I mean, you can't say that in a parliamentary answer. There's not room. There may also be things that you can't say on grounds of confidentiality, relations with other governments. There may be other reasons why you do not want to include certain things in it. However, it is still the duty to give an account which is not misleading. So when I appeared before Lord Justice Scott, I tried to explain this distinction, that you're not always either able or free say everything that you know. It's your duty in those circumstances to try to give an account which is not misleading.
I think we've got time for just another couple. The back there.
Because I think I would try to persuade you to enter it for the reason that I entered it, in which I haven't been disappointed. The quality and the interest of the job, and the fact that there is an integrity about it and an objectivity about it, which is very valuable. I've found throughout my civil service career that on the whole, it's not who you are or what pull you have. The guy with the best argument wins. And the woman for that matter as well. And you are working in an area of very great importance to the community, also one which you read about every day in the newspapers and about which there's a good deal of public debate, which gives it a certain spice. So, I mean, you may say, what have I got to complain about? Because no, I'm not the best paid person in the civil service by any means. There's lots of private sector people who've been brought in who are better paid than I am, but I've got no reason to complain about my pay. But even, I think you would find middle-ranking people in the civil service who could be very much better paid outside, but have not had a wasted life, have had a fulfilled life, because they've enjoyed the contents of the job and they've enjoyed the colleagues that they've worked with. That would be my pitch to you.
Could I add to that, Robin, the fact that for many jobs in large bureaucracies, and there'll be a lot of those left, the civil service training is, I would say, almost incomparable. I mean, it is a very good way of getting training. And these days, the job, the decision is not irrevocable. I mean,
yeah.
Robin hasn't actually done time in the private sector, but I've flipped in and out of the civil service. And looking round this audience, I can see others who have also been both members of the private, public, and indeed the academic sectors. So it's nothing like as irrevocable a decision as it was in your father's time. And I would guess you would say all for the better.
I would say for the better. I mean, I think that the civil service is actually strengthened provided you can keep political patronage out of it, if people have experience of both the public and the private sector and move freely between them. There are problems about that, of which the disparity of pay is one, but it is what we're trying to achieve.
One final question. Who would like to ask the last one? Oh, right, Jeff.
Looking at over the next 30 to 40 years, have you had more and more people moving in and out of formal functions or to agencies? Will it still be meaningful to speak of a civil service culture, a common culture? And if so, will that be carried by an inner core of people who actually do remain in their lives, or what will it be born by?
Well, it's a very interesting question. I hope and I believe that it will. And what will define it is the climate, the structure, political accountability that I've described. What distinguishes the civil service is that you are in a structure of accountability, of political accountability, where ministers can always be asked to defend your action. That puts certain obligations upon you. And in my view, that is quite as unifying a factor as, for example, working for ICI, where you've been maybe working in paint or fertilizers or chemicals with different terms and conditions in different parts of the world, but you're an employee of ICI. I think that the bonds that bind the civil service together will actually be stronger than those that bond the big multinational company at Brussels.
Well, it falls to me to thank you, Robin, formally on behalf of everybody, for a truly fascinating and very frank view of an institution of which the UK has been rightly proud, should continue to be proud, but which is clearly, at the moment, to use a word that I use frequently in this forum, in a state of some turbulence. And I couldn't help thinking, as you were listing the changes that had happened post-Fulton, how many of them had their parallels in the academic world too. We too have lost tenure. We too have been criticized for the jobs for life, for the too cozy atmosphere, and so on and so forth. And I think we understand very well the stresses and strains that the civil service is going through, sympathize with you, but also recognize both the inevitability of much of it and, dare I say, the improvements that come from sharpening up, particularly some of those rules of accountability. So on behalf of all your audience, thank you very much indeed.
Thank you very much.